Hey Joe, how you doing?
Tim, I'm just terrific. How are you?
Very good. Tonight you wanted to talk about pornography. I guess pornography as a political weapons, a tool of a weapon in psychological warfare.
I did, and I will.
Okay. I mean, come on, Joe. Pornography. Lighten up, man. It's just there
I
to entertain
know.
us, spice things up a little bit,
Yeah,
right?
I know. I'm just really uptight, Tim. I just can't enjoy myself somehow. I should just relax and watch the Kardashian sex tape. But that's just not me. And I smell a rat when I see the degree of pornography that has come into our culture. And I do think it was designed, and I think it was part of the way that the family was attacked, basically. The goal was to atomize, to break apart European culture and leave it in a form that would be really easy for a tiny minority to have complete control over. And developed a technology to genocide this population. I think that was just the general plan that we're experiencing. I was going to give a kind of a strange history of pornography, one that I've never actually heard anyone else describe, but is the it is the method that I think was used, and oddly enough, it comes through fairy tales. To start sort of like my understanding of like how did pornography get to be basically, I've seen different statistics, but 30% of all activity in the internet is pornography watching. I've seen other statistics that, by the time a male is 20, they have like, 2,000 hours of pornography watching in. And I've also seen that the actual sexual activity of these individuals goes down. So, in other words, they are basically moved into a fantasy world of sex. And this diminishes their participation in a real world of sex. And of course, I mentioned that pornography trains people. It actually, of course, sets up expectations about what sex is. And when you think of a 17 or an 18-year-old boy going on a date with a young woman, the expectations are obviously different for someone who's been through pornography training, and it's hard to imagine romance actually having a chance, and certainly monogamous long relationships, just sort of self-evident to
Yeah,
me
like
that
courtship.
they're
Yeah.
not going to happen.
Yeah, traditional courtship, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Traditional courtship is just destroyed by pornography. So.
Hooking up becomes the norm, yeah.
So how did this happen? Well, I mean the many people trace it to Marx, of course. When Marx brought out the Communist Manifesto, he actually spent quite a bit of time talking about the family and about how that was going to have to be destroyed. After his death, Engels produced a whole tract that he had written before Marx's death with Karl Marx, which outlined that basically they were going to, in the new workers' paradise, they were going to dissolve monogamy. They were going to encourage pre and extramarital sex, and they wanted to basically. And there's a quote, the gradual growth of unconstrained sexual intercourse. Now, this would, of course, enabled unmarried women to be able to have their housework nationalized, and then because the children would not be under their care, and then mothers could be shifted into factories, the lumpen proletariat. Children would be moved into daycare nurseries, and then there'd be community collectives apart from their natural parents, and then the society in general would rear and educate children. You know, sort of sounds like Beverly Hills, doesn't it? So
yet another plank in the communist agenda that has been enacted.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is just amazingly prescient, because, of course, the Marxist Revolution didn't happen, but, you know, the cultural Marxist Revolution did in fact occur. But this platform, you know, the Marxist vision of, you know, unmarried women with children in daycare centers, you know, collectives raising the children and unconstrained sexual intercourse, you know, is a vision that was then adopted by the intellectual heir of Karl Marx, a person that we've spoken about, but hasn't gotten, I think, enough sunlight put on him. And that was this little guy named Gregor Luchas, not his real name. The guy that we know as sort of the founder of cultural Marxism and political correctness and the Frankfurt School was born Gregory Bernat Loewinger. He changed his name to Luchas to basically sound Hungarian. So kind of a crypto Jew, you might say. Now, oddly, the guy that he actually worked with during the Hungarian Soviet, Bela Kun, had also changed his name from Cohen to Kun, because Kun is Magar, and he didn't want, I guess, Bela didn't want to sound Jewish either. And so during this period, which is just seminal to like our current culture, wherein the Hungarian Soviet existed, you got to see Gregor Luchas in action, because he was made the deputy commentator of people's culture. You know, you don't even know what this title means anymore. But basically, he was in control of public education, theater, just about anything that was propaganda or you know, was part of how culture was being created. He was put in control of it. Now, good thing to remember about old Gregor is he's a mass murderer. You know, you get the talk about the you know, the workers' paradise, but if you scratch the surface of these people, like Lenin is an example, well, you just see mass murder. And Gregor is the same way. He is known to have executed about 8 soldiers for just basically questioning his authority, and then was also, with Bela Kun, recorded by an eyewitness as basically saying, you know, they were drawing up lists of people to be executed, and Gregor said, you know, they can judge us if they will or if they can, right? So this pure moral nihilism, right? And this is also very important, because I'm going to show that this is the moral authority, because when you go forward in time, Tim, you come up with this big problem. When you get to MK Ultra, people scratch their head and they go, well, who would be so evil? Who would have the moral authority to actually create something like the acid test, where you'd give LSD to children, right, or teenagers? Who would have this moral authority? Well, the moral authority is found in the Hungarian Soviet with Bela Kun and Gregor Luchas, because they would execute people whenever they would feel like it. And they would also try to destroy and vaporize European culture. Okay. So what Luchas is very well known for sex education. This is really the very first kind of risque sex education that I'm aware of. This is the very first time. It occurred in 1919, I believe, during the 133-day Hungarian Soviet. And so Luchas wanted to put in a sex education that would be basically the cultural side of what Marx had envisioned, right? So you would give, the kids, children, the idea that they should have unbridled sexual intercourse, and they should basically not pay any attention to their parents, right? That was literally his vision. Now, Luchas was the commissat of public education. That was one of his titles. And he had about 120,000 proletariat children under his control. And so he was teaching them this berserk sex education. But here is the part that is never mentioned and I think is actually more important. And this is really, I think, something that I think will become significant in the future as, you know, more and more people start to become aware of like the whole project. But so what Lucas did is he was working with Balazs. I mean, I can't pronounce these names, Tim. And these are all like these weird Hungarian names, like three umlauts and a semicolon. But it's Balazs. And he hadn't changed his name. He's just this Jewish guy working with Gregor Luchas and Bela Kun or Kohn. And they set up what they called fairy tale afternoons. Now, this is critical to understand because you've got to think about the influence that Luchas has going forward. Because Luchas basically went with the Frankfurt School. He then, you know, creates what we call political correctness. Feminism stems directly from this. And also ultimately pornography. But something else came out of the mix, something which was hand in hand with pornography, and I think is actually part of the same thing. And if I don't mind, I'll go through this. They wanted to teach children fairy tales so that they would have every afternoon, 120,000 lumpen proletariat kids would be marched into these education thing, and they would be read fairy tales, and these were very bizarre, you know, eerie. Some of them are almost need a little sunlight put on them because I don't have good translations, but I can tell you these are creepy fairy tales. But anyway, some communists, right, they go, what the heck? Why fairy tales? They said children should be taught Soviet reality. No fantasy. No, 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 said Luchas. He said, children could understand the world only through the medium of fairy tales. In them, they encountered a world in which everything is possible for everyone in accord with inner worth, where the characters change not only their class, but also their form and their life. Such a world is more communist than our communism. We've abolished only the differences between human classes with the possibility provided by enchantment. The fairy tale erased the borders between animal, vegetable, and human beings, between every existing and non-existing being. So this was the plan, right? And this is something that is just, to my knowledge, not mentioned even by like people who really criticize, political correctness and things. Just read it again. We will abolish with our fairy tales and with the kids' association with them more than just the differences between human classes, but with enchantment, We will erase the border between animals and human beings. Okay. Now, one thing you got to remember about the Hungarian Soviet is that, you know, I've mentioned these Jewish guys, but there's another component. It's the Freemasons. There are so many damn Freemasons that when the Hungarian people basically kicked these guys out, what happens is the Romanians, who had been battling them, come in, and the Soviet, the Hungarian Soviet, skedaddles. But immediately after that, the Hungarian people basically created a pogrom, you know, just a cultural attack on the Masons, because they knew that they had been involved with this. Okay, they knew that they had been part of this basically series of atrocities and the sex education and all this stuff. They were well aware of it, and so they went after the Masons, and actually for a period of time they had kicked them out. So now, okay, I just want to go forward a bit. I know we're talking about pornography and I'll get there, but just what's important is when you see this combination of the you know, kind of cultural Marxism, the pornography, and this idea about fairy tales and enchantment, you know, you have the Masons involved. Now, where does this pop up again? Well, it's with Disney, Walt Disney. Now, Walt Disney, of course, is a huge Mason, right? He has this demolé childhood that's completely weird. He says the demolé, the Freemason training, was what set him up for the rest of his life, all the success. And he was in what was called the Uplifters Club, which was actually, the real title was Uplifting Lucifer. Just nice, wholesome, you know, start to Disneyland. But you see, it's this combination of Masonic control and this mind control business where they're using enchantment and fairy tales. And then when they talk about they want to erase the borders between, you know, animals and human beings. Okay, now go forward just a few years. This was actually like 1920. 1928 or and maybe 32, in that era, just a decade later, you get a cartoon called Bimbo's Initiation. Now, this is impossible for me to think is not part of the same project, because Bimbo's Initiation is a cartoon where Mickey Mouse, okay, this man mouse, right? You know, the idea of blurring the distinctions, you know, between men and animals, locks this kind of dog-like man named Bimbo in a Freemason lodge. They then do all sorts of tortures to Bimbo to make him join the Masons. He refuses, but then they bring out Betty Boop and she does a sexy dance. He is mesmerized and joins. Okay. So now you get into, you know, this Mickey Mouse business. And now you look at Tim and you go, well, the Mouseketeers, right? Do you remember, or did you ever encounter the Mouseketeers?
Yes, I remember in the 1970s. They would rerun them on local stations.
Well, the Mouseketeers were basically this, you know, you had this erasing of the borders, yeah, between men, animals, and human beings. And they all, the kids all wear these mouse hats. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, to bring it all back to pornography, I think you're looking at basically just, you know, two sides of the same trajectory. And when you see that, you know, they had the fairy tale afternoons, and they also had the sex education, the pornographic sex education for the kids in Hungary. I think that that was basically that distinction then comes forward into America, and we get, you know, the Enchanted Kingdom with Walt Disney and the blurring of the animals and humans. But you also, at the same time, or very close to the same time, You get, you know, the ratcheting up of pornography. These things are basically hand in glove in my mind. You know, you get Screw Magazine, which is really kind of the, I think, a starting point for the pornography that ends up on the internet. It was without any romantic component whatsoever. And it was sold, you know, to the deracinated white middle class. And I think that with a little work, you can see that, you know, from Marx to Luchas to Disney with Bimbo's Initiation, and then, you know, into Al Goldstein and Screw Magazine, with a little help from Edward Bernays and FDR, mm-hmm. right, when you know, he took away the ability of the small sovereigns to be able to create legislation to prevent, you know, sexual degeneracy. I think it's a plan, Tim. I think that these things are, in my mind, really hard to imagine that they would just sort of appear spontaneously with so much parallelism, you know, as you go through history.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you mentioned the 1950s, that generation had been subject to so much psychological warfare. Because 16 million men had been drafted into the armed forces. And, of course, that's one thing the armed forces does well is subject people to social engineering. It's one big social engineering, you know, operation. But they would emerge into the late 40s and 50s. And at the same time, you have MK Ultra. You have the emergence of course, Disneyland out in California. Yeah. Both SRI is involved in that and consulting in both programs. But you also have the introduction of the mainstreaming of pornography. I would say that, you know, publications like Screw Magazine were always on the fringe. But you had Playboy. And Playboy started in the early 50s. In the moment of great serendipity, I think, Hugh Hefner.
Yeah.
Got his hands on the nude photographs of Marilyn Monroe just before she became a huge star, and that was there was the that momentum from that that launched the Playboy empire and the legitimization of pornography, the promotion of the idea of the Playboy. That's one part of the dialectic. The other dialectic, of course, is feminism. You have the cad versus the feminist. And this becomes the two polar opposites, you know.
And notice that Hefner also uses the human animal,
the bunny. It's a dehumanization. Yeah, yeah. There's a reductionism that occurs because you're not, when you start to blur the distinction between man and animal, you're not raising the animal. You're reducing man to that level, and obviously pornography is involved in that because pornography reduces the person, whether it's the female and the male, to an object to be utilized for one's immediate gratification, if not consumption. So, yeah, there's definitely something there with that. You trace it back to Karl Marx. The politicization of pornography, according to E. Michael Jones, is the French Revolution and the Marquis de Sade, where he used pornography to excite the passions, to create a revolutionary fervor. Later political authorities have determined that pornography can be used to sort of anesthetize the masses, beguile them, and, you know, distract them. Nevertheless, it's used to manipulate the passions, the appetites, so you can you can guide the masses in some political objective or some social engineering agenda. But the big thing with pornography, I think, was techniques have become more refined along with whatever technology is at their disposal. Obviously, pornography was limited before the age of photography. I think the Marquis de Sade used etchings or drawings, which obviously has a limited capability to excite the libido, to excite the passions. But the moment photography was perfected and refined, and of course, moving pictures and the development of the Nickelodeon, which is strange enough the name of a children's TV station, TV network. But Nickelodeon's promoted pornography, again, owned, dominated by Jews. The motion picture industry, and then, of course, then broadcast television, of course, that was restricted for many years. But, of course, the motion picture industry pornography, then you have with the internet, of course, and then with these mobile devices where internet, where pornography is now at everyone's fingertips. It's no holds barred now. So it's technology plays a huge function in the could you say, the power of pornography as a weapon. And now it's everywhere. And as it became more normalized, we don't even acknowledge the standard fare. What an early generation would consider pornography is no longer considered pornography. You know, what's on HBO or King of Thrones or The Sopranos, if you watch some of these shows, which are remarkably well produced many times, but they throw in a lot of sex. They throw in the crap with the good stuff, and that's all part of the psychological warfare that's going on there. So technology plays a huge part in this, but it was acknowledged, of course, with pornography, if you can get people to become a slave to their passions, they would become a political slave. Because as St. Augustine said, man has many masters as he has vices. And so these people acknowledged, I think, the psychological warriors and the social engineers took note of this and have refined their weaponry. And today, so many people are so enslaved to these, to sexual desire and passion. And if you know, traditionally, the way to be free is you had to, freedom was to live a moral life, was not to do what you want to do, whatever that you feel like doing. But if you give in to your appetites, you become a slave to those appetites, and whoever is in a position to supply the goods that satisfy those appetites become your master. And the trick behind pornography is that people want it. They desire it. And when you desire something that is indeed forging those chains that enslave you, you don't recognize the slavery. And that's why it's so insidious and so effective. And people have internalized it so that whenever you warn people about this, if someone isn't conscious of it, they won't understand what you're talking about. Because pornography is freedom. It's, you know, it's license. It's to do what
sex,
you want.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah. But it's that vision, though, that idea that pornography and sexual liberation is freedom, of course, is contradicted by the reality is that for every action there is a reaction or there's consequences. And sex is a funny way of making babies. People have forgotten that. And that's the problem, is that when you make children, you have the responsibility to take care of them. Whether you're a mother or a father, and mother and father have specific roles to play in this. Women give birth and nurture the child. The father supports the mother and the child and performs the function, provider, protector, and example. But the sexual revolution, which was powered by pornography, says no. Make love, not war. We're free. We're sexually free, and you can carry on, act, you know, like a cad, act like a whore, and not accept the responsibilities for your actions. And the only problem with that is, of course, is that that just creates sort of societal anarchy, which then creates the conditions that the oligarchs want. They don't want a moral order, because morality is a check on their power. They don't want morality. They want anarchy. And an anarchy, some people say, is liberty. It's the oligarchs that rule.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're social animals. Freedom is the ability to produce the culture that we flourish within. Mm-hmm. That's freedom, right? So freedom is the capacity to be a father, a mother, have a family, associate with people that promote your family, extended families, your ethnicity. I mean, this is freedom, right? When someone says, well, here's pornography or drugs, you don't want to be tied down to this other situation because of its structure. It's always, you know, just sophistry. It's always evil with a clever way of fooling people, because there's really no way to escape our nature. We are social creatures. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't have family, we have failed. We are not at peace. So anything that prevents family from being produced is evil. There is evil defined clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get, Marx, who was using ideas from the French Revolution, and I'm 100% in agreement with E. Michael Jones, that the French Revolution definitely had sexual libertine themes, which were destructive to culture, and they were deliberately created. And it was a Masonic project, in my mind. You know, mm-hmm. I think all of these revolutions, if you scratch into them, you'll see the Masons in play. I think Marx is just kind of tidy to deal with because he leads right into Gregor Lucas, and then you get you're right in a pipeline to MK Ultra and sex, drugs, and rock and roll and the counterculture. But I think that when Bella Kuhn Cohn and Gregor Lucas Loewinger were talking about how to arrange Hungarian Soviet culture, they were using principles that had already been developed and used in the French Revolution and were being touted by Marx as part of the workers' paradise. So all of this is, clever people lying to what basically were defenseless, proletariat, peasants, people who had not really, didn't have the capacity to defend themselves against those who could seize the, reins of power and then had the psychological expertise and the malevolence and hatred, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because remember, they're saying workers' paradise, but in back of it there, you can see that it's very clear they're actually going to destroy the culture and then wipe out the population.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of this, every bit of this, is moving toward, World War II and the Holocaust of the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is all, we're heading just straight there. And if you look at the sexual libertine culture in like the 30s in Berlin, mm-hmm. Very famous, it's all coming right out of this. The same individuals, you can just trace it right along. In America, our little country, I think that it's important for people to recognize that, the conditioning that brings about pornography, that brings about, let's talk about that in detail in a second, but, is a large cultural project. There's different elements to it, and you have to be kind of on your toes to make sure you're not, being influenced. Pornography, is damaging in one way that it conditions males to have a certain kind of expectation about what happens in sex. So you have in pornography, you have very graphic, quasi unnatural sex, certainly not romantic sex at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have really young women, right? You rarely, it's probably 99% is with young women. And so,
and airbrushed.
And airbrushed. Yeah. So what this is doing is it's giving males this expectation about what is sexually stimulating. And so then when you encounter a real woman, someone you could actually have as a mate and have develop a family with and have a relationship that would be beneficial in a deep sense, it doesn't look normal, right? You've been conditioned by the airbrushed, paid stunt women that pornography uses to expect a certain kind of activity and just a certain way the woman is going to look. And so then how does romance, you really have a chance with normal people, let alone the idea of developing of family? And again, we are social creatures. If you're if the goal is simply to acquire the kind of sex that you see in the pornographic films that are being watched so relentlessly now, particularly by young males, you've lost sight of the whole purpose of your life and the whole construction of your real happiness. You can now see, because pornography has been prevalent for, you know, a couple decades now, you know, you can see, you know, people who are basically enjoying the pornographic culture when they were 22 through 25, and now they're 40. How much enjoyment are they having now?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it leads to, you know, isolated, debauched, and unhappy lives. And when you think about it, I was looking at the statistic, I mentioned it last week, that, you know, the opioid addiction and epidemic in America, I think it's directly related to this. I think that if you got into these statistics, what you'd find are a lot of males who are really in agony, and they don't quite understand why. You know, the pornographic lifestyle worked so well when they were 20 years old. Hookup sex, you know, drugs, and libertine lifestyle with no responsibilities. And now, you know, suddenly at 40, you know, they are completely vacant. They don't have any social connections. There's just nothing in their lives, and they're not going toward any kind of, you know, place where there can ever be peace for them.
Isn't that the perfect subject for the New World Order?
That exactly right. Mm-hmm. Just give him a few Oxycontin every day, and he's ideal.
Mm-hmm. I would argue the 40-year-old, you know, directionless male who's indulged in pornography his entire life is as damaged probably as the you know, the homosexual.
Of course.
Yeah, and that's a whole other sexual dysfunction. But obviously, homosexuals don't corner the market on sexual dysfunction or perversion or degenerate behavior. It's just you can, when you're young, in your early 20s, that type of behavior isn't quite as obscene, I guess you could say, because you can say you mark it up to youth, but there comes a point when a person has to grow up. The pornography that you're talking about, the prevalence of pornography, creates arrested development. These people never mature, and it goes back to that dysfunction because they simply cannot form bonding relationships with the opposite sex, with the female. And then the 20s is so important for that. Traditionally, the 20s was thought to be the time when you did this, particularly for females, because of fertility issues. But nevertheless, that was when you got married and started a family. Well, now it's the 30s, mid to late 30s. And what is that due to population growth? What is that due to reproduction? Obviously, women's fertility declines even in the 20s. So that's they have precious few years when they're most attractive and most fertile. Funny, when they're most attractive, they're most fertile. Funny how that works, isn't it?
Right.
But they squander these years on careers and, you know, what they think matters, having a job, equality as is understood. And it's they've been sold a bill of goods. And women wonder why they can't find good men. Well, can't find good men because they're addicted to pornography.
Right.
You know, well, to one degree or another. Because it's been so normalized.
I think that, you know, we talked about having a restaurant for, you know, people to get away from the normies last week, you know, our own little club. But I think that in all seriousness, it's not a bad idea to basically try to establish kind of a pornography free zone of some kind, you know, that men and women can come together and basically exchange ideas about how difficult it is in this destructive culture. The culture is not, you know, damaged. I mean, it's been attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that the men and women that you know should be able to form these relationships and cannot need to come together and hopefully with one another say, look, here's our situation. The culture was designed by Gregor Luchas Loewinger and Bella Kuhn Cohn and Walt Disney and the Freemasons, and they did this to keep us from having a life that is fully satisfying and the one that we're really designed to have. Mm-hmm. Because, see, this is the bottom line, is that why do the males in the 40s take opioids? It's because they're not living the life that they are really designed to have. They're designed to be fathers, and they're designed to be husbands, and they're designed to be in a community of these kinds of organizations. This is billion years of evolution, right? And it is howling in the soul of this male who is alone, right? He is not in a world that he can ever find any kind of peace in, because his evolution is creating the understanding that this is all wrong, that I haven't done what I needed to do in order to create a life that was real. And the opioids are now, you know, filling the gap. Women, I mean, just my heart just goes out to them, because they aren't as victimized by pornography to themselves, mm-hmm. but they are victimized in the sense that they don't have mates that are appropriate. There just aren't males that are out there that aren't psychologically damaged or chemically damaged. It's just hard to find, you know, kind of a real natural man.
Well, look at the divorce rate.
Yeah.
And how many of them had fathers that didn't leave? Yeah. Absentee fathers. I mean, ambivalent or absentee fathers is a huge psychological trauma. And that manifests in many different things. I think that's one of the sexual dysfunction or, I think things like homosexuality is epiphenomenal from trauma or family dysfunction. Same things with the inability to grow up to be a man and what it takes to be a man. But you also have a society now, as you know, with pornography, and we have a society that's so hypersexualized, it's constantly titillating and stimulating the male libido, and then punishing the male for acting out upon the stimulation. That's when you get the feminist reaction with this sort of this Victorian, almost Victorian speech codes and behavior codes and workplace harassment and these things. You know, they don't acknowledge the world that they created, but then there's no logic. You don't look for these people to be logical or fair about it, because the whole point about it is to confuse everybody, is to send these mixed signals so everyone's fighting. There's no, you know,
yeah,
you know, that's the whole point. That's the whole point of it. That's just why the laws and aren't consistent with custom and nature and reality, and the whole system designed for the type of anarchy and confusion they were experiencing today. And this results in two reactions. One is this wacko feminist movement. Then you have this sort of this men's rights movement, men going their own way, where men just sort of give up, you know, and like, oh, is that what being a man is, really? Giving up, you know, stand up and fight it a little bit. That's not what a man does. And quite frankly, the key thing here is consciousness, because if you acknowledge it, if you become conscious of pornography, of the toxic culture, how weaponized it is, how bad it is, and how it's been waged against us for decades. And this requires a little research, a little time, a little thought, turning off a little TV, getting away from the entertainment. And then its effectiveness wears off. It's blunted. It's no longer as powerful. And you can realize that, you know, and you might be able to find people that you agree with if you can articulate it. The first part of being able to think about it is to be able to articulate it. If you can articulate it, you can understand it. And then you can get around it. You can combat it. Which is the purpose of why we're talking about it right now, I suppose.
Exactly right. And that's why in the proposed Kelly Atwell dating service.
made me spit up water
in the
there.
Questionnaire. We're going to have, do you recognize that, and this would be for the males, do you recognize that pornography basically leads you to insanity?
Yeah.
I mean, things like this that we would then be able to, with the right questions, pick out males that have some promise and hope,
mm-hmm.
and then pass them to women and say, look, you know, we can't warrant this guy completely, but you may have something you can work with
here. Well, I mean, I myself, this in the past 10, 15 years, as I've become more conscious of these things, have adjusted my consumption and what I watch. Because, oh, yeah, I recognize this stuff, whereas 15 years ago, I might not recognize it. When we're all coming aware of these things. Ian Michael Jones's books, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control, it should be mandatory reading. You know, and because this goes through a long, it's a rich history of pornography as a political weapon. I may read The Dust Jacket. It gives a great summation here. The logic is clear enough. Those who wish to liberate man from the moral order needed to impose social controls as soon as they succeeded, because liberated libido led inevitably to anarchy. Over the course of 200 years, those techniques became more and more refined, eventuating in a world where people were controlled, not by military force, but by the skillful management of their passions. It was Aldous Huxley who wrote in his preface to the 1946 edition of Brave New World that as political and economic freedom diminishes, sexual freedom tends to compensatingly to increase. This book is about the converse of that statement. It explains how the rhetoric of sexual freedom was used to engineer a system of covert political and social control over the course of 200-year span. Covered by this book, the development of technologies of communication, reproduction, and psychic control, including psychotherapy, behaviorism, advertising, sensitivity training, pornography, and when push came to shove, plain old blackmail, allowed the Enlightenment and its heirs to turn Augustine's insight on its head and create masters out of men's vices. So,
yeah, well said, and in general, quite correct. You have an understanding. Okay, so this is great, and I bet you most of the people that listen to us are kind of already there. But a lot of them, I bet, are not having the relationships that they would like to have. So the question is how to, what can be done about this? And it's a head scratcher. I wish I had more solutions because, you know, I look at it from the perspective of women. I think it's sort of, the males are kind of, it's sort of easy to understand the situation. They've been subjected to pornography, and then they're filling the gap with opioids. They really don't have any interest in keeping a job, and they're on welfare of some kind.
They've been systematically emasculated.
Yeah, and they're just basically useless as husbands at this point. On the other side, you know, I think women haven't succumbed as much to the opioids and obviously pornography. And so many of them are still, you know, sort of clear-minded. So how do you develop mates? Well, there has to be some kind of a way to transition males into a better direction, right? I mean, I know it's tough, but, some of the ideas I've had are we need to develop our own literature. One thing that really damages us, Tim, is we are not in any control over our culture. And by that, I mean our media. All of the films and the internet platforms and the literature being produced by people that basically want to see the Europeans exterminate.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're like, a European woman and you go, gee, you know, this doesn't look too promising. How do you transition? Well, one thing is we need to create some new literature, some literature that is based in romance. And and I think one theme I would hope you might be developed is just a romance that could develop that would basically cure the protagonist. So in other words, you have a man and a woman, they're not able to have a relationship because of the cultural destruction that they've experienced, right? The weapons, cultural weapons. But they become aware of it, and then they have a kind of a restoration through knowledge of their physical prowess and strength and beings, and then because of that, they can actually have a family. Now, that's not the Kardashian story.
No.
But it is a story of an ethnicity, of a people that has a future. So that would be something I would like to see, is that, and you see, these kinds of romance novels, to use a term, they might be the basis for organizations.
Well, yeah, I mean, talented writers, even movie makers, if they weren't, controlled by malevolent forces of Hollywood, could produce movies with that theme in it. I mean, watched some of the great movies. I'm thinking, Tender Mercies, the Robert Duvall in the early 80s. And also even to Kill a Mockingbird, just think about this, the story about common people, decent people doing what's right. These sort of encouraging movies that are timeless. If you watch it, they're much more timeless than, say, Animal House or Porky's, right? I mean, so it can be done, producing the literature, and the entertainment that would promote these sort of things. There were, in the old days, some TV, like the old shows like the Waltons, things like that.
I would just say, Tim, that we can't try to plug into the show business construction, because we have to realize that there is a complete fusion between, like, the Academy Awards and the most degenerate pornography on the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all come from the same place. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do is try to use, the powers of our ability to create and make movies and literature that don't even try to get into that world.
Mm-hmm.
We're not interested in, like, having an MGM film or, getting, Oliver Stone a treatment about our novel. I mean, we've got to really separate ourselves culturally in order to start moving in a better direction, because every single person inside the current system of media is wired into the evil.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is why the 20th century was so crucial in this battle. We've talked about this before, because these institutions that are now so overtly malevolent, for several decades, were kept on a short leash by people that had ethnic and religious consciousness, and particularly the Catholic. The Catholic
The production code,
the ethnic neighborhoods.
That was something that restrained, at least in the major media, pornography. But I think that was just, I don't know if you're familiar with my ideas on this, but I always thought that was just a setup, that really what they wanted was a political cover to be able to expand the network of the media.
That is what they did. I mean, television. Look at television.
Thousands of theaters and then the TV networks all came into existence. And
look how benign television was in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, because before the production code, there was a hue and cry. I mean, people thought, particularly, go into this, but people thought after the Fatty Arbuckle event,
mm-hmm,
that Hollywood was basically a plot to destroy European culture.
I guess they're right.
They're right. And so then Hollywood responded with the production code, but this was just basically a way to put people to sleep, because they had the Catholics supporting it and they had all of this structure. But as soon, and under that cover, then they were able to, create the theater system and the TV networks. And as soon as the network was developed,
mm-hmm,
then here comes the pawnbroker, with the mm-hmm power, the moral power of the Holocaust in back of it, and naked breasts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end. So they basically, in my mind, the production code, while it's a noble idea, simply was used as a political cover to establish the physical network that pornography could then move out into the culture with. And so, and if you look at the background of Hayes, the guy who ran it, I mean, he was a Freemason who worked with Edward Bernays, in the War is Good department for Wilson. So he was just as dirty as any human could be. And that was why, you know, Hollywood selected him.
A good example of what's going on now, what occurred in America, perhaps in the 60s and 70s, is what I understand is also occurring now in India. Because under the IMF rules, what they happened was, on the condition, these conditionalities that IMF sets, they pried open India's media market and deregulated it and started pumping in all the pornography of the West.
That's right, exactly.
Now they have a rape crisis in India because the males are being stimulated and excited by this media that's completely alien to them.
So there's one world order.
Yeah.
And one world order requires no family order.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just going to be a vast array of unconnected humans that will all be, on opioids and doing the bidding of the oligarchs while they're in existence, which won't be very long because, you know, we'll be down to 400 million as the Georgia Guidestones predict very shortly.
Now, so, there's one pattern that I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it with pornography is the overwhelmingly Jewish influence in the promotion of pornography, not only just as entertainment, also as political weapon. Because, of course, you have Wilhelm Reich, Mass Psychology of Fascism, promoting sexual license as a stepping stone for political revolution. You have to change the sexual constitution to upend the political constitution. You have Herbert Marcuse. You have the publication of the Authoritarian Personality by the American Jewish Committee, working in conjunction with CIA and the WASP establishment.
Well, I mean, the American Jewish Committee's production of the Authoritarian Personality was just a project of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah,
my point is,
is this the revolutionary sort of subversive strain that we see so much in organized Jewry throughout the years?
Well, you know, it's hard to know if it's just a small group that has it in for Europeans and wants to,
mm-hmm.
Or is there just something kind of fundamental at the base of it? I don't know, but I know that those who are victims of this need to look honestly at history. And just say, wait a second, there's just too much Jewish influence. I mean, you mentioned Marcuse, but don't forget, you know, you have Marx, Freud,
mm-hmm.
Lukas, and then, of course, Hollywood.
I guess Carl Jung and Watson didn't do much good either. They weren't Jews, but you could say they were following.
Well, but then you get into the question of Masons. It's sort of like Walt Disney, brings about the Enchanted Kingdom, and you go, well, Walt was, Episcopalian or something. But I would just label him as what I would call an Episcopalian question mark. I'm not sure what it is really, but I mean, I think he was Episcopalian. But it's a question mark because, what kind of a Christian is in an organization called Uplifting Lucifer, and what sort of a Christian takes Masonic oaths, and what sort of a Christian has Club 33 on his park? It seems to me he is a question mark, and so that's why I've been in a lot of other shows I've done. I'd say, look, we really it'd be very clarifying to get the ethnic background, the family backgrounds of people like Walt Disney, Hugh Hefner, right? Aldous Huxley, right? I mean, this would really be valuable to know what we're dealing with, because as we sit here, I just think you've got, you have this tremendous Jewish influence.
Yeah, there was Dr. Nathan Abrams, who is a world authority on Jewish pornography, and he wrote about it. I think it was in Jewish Quarterly back in 2004 about the Jewish dominance in the porn industry, saying it's a good thing because it liberates us. This is one of the cases where if you point this out, if you say Jews are responsible for pornography, you're being anti-Semitic. But if you look at pornography as progressive and promoting freedom, then they can take credit for it. But you can't have one without the other, logically. Of course, the obvious example of Hollywood, the Jewish dominance in Hollywood, and the type of, the cultural sewer that is Hollywood. And you have Neil Gabel's book, Empire of Their Own, about the Jewish moguls in Hollywood and how they created America, their influence in America. And you have Joel Stein writing LA Times about a decade ago saying, of course, Jews control Hollywood. And it's a good thing that we control Hollywood. But if you take collective credit for Hollywood, you have to also have to take some sort of collective responsibility for it, too. You can't have one without the other.
Right. You know. And you see, I just feel at this point, you know, they can, like those people you gave the, you know, you mentioned that, well, they were saying it's liberating. This is sort of like the worker's paradise argument. Mm-hmm. You might be able to fool people the first couple times and the first, you know, 100 million people you kill. But after a while, I think it's incumbent upon the victims to say, you know, I just can't buy this crap anymore. And when they say, you know, pornography is liberating, when you look at, the opioid epidemic in, what were middle class individuals, when you look at the, you know, the catastrophic single mom, statistics.
And everything that comes from that.
That's right. I think at this point we can really say, you know, we really are not interested in your argument anymore. And in fact, I have a baseball bat here. Let me show you what I think about your argument. Really think it's sincere. I think you know perfectly well that you're destroying a culture. So
it doesn't it doesn't withstand just the slightest bit of scrutiny because we all have appetites, right? We all understand that our appetites have to be regulated, whether we're eating, and that also comes to sex. There's context and the time for everything. If you were free to eat whatever you want, and you become obese, you have to acknowledge that your obesity is a function of the fact that you can't control your appetite. Okay? And there's a moral lesson there. Morality is practical reason. Okay? It's how we function in life, how we get along with each other, how we live live a good life. We have to live a moral life because there's consequences for these actions. So, obviously, if you don't restrain yourself sexually, you're going to end up a very unhappy person. You're going to do a lot of harm. So to me, the fact that people even swallow this argument, and this is why they have to create things like contraception and abortion, right? To get around the fact that, hey, you make babies, then you have responsibility. There's no such thing as sexual freedom. You're just simply shifting the cost off to somebody else, whether it's an aborted baby, an abandoned child, an abandoned mother with a child, or society with swollen welfare rolls and all the crime and all the social pathologies that come from that. It's because you're not doing what you should do.
And the question is how to get young males to understand this. The time that these lessons really need to be taken to heart is, 13 through 18, so that a young male doesn't develop habits of pornographic lifestyle, that he's able basically to resist, Hollywood and internet pornography as far as influencing him. In America, you see there is still some resistance in some Christian communities. Mm-hmm. They're still able, but they have to really work hard to sequester themselves culturally, that's why I think that to really make progress, what we need is a large scale cultural awakening that there has been weaponized anthropology placed against us.
So this is a consciousness of the malevolence, the organized malevolence.
Yeah.
So people have to be open to the idea of conspiracy.
Oh dear. Well, that, I hate to say it, but there really isn't any other way. People need to be able to at least consider that we got here not because we were just having fun. It's like you talk to these old males, and they're on opioids, they're obese. They've had like 3 suicide attempts, and you say, well, how's it going? And they say, yeah, you know, gosh, we sure had fun in the 60s, didn't we, though? And they arch their eyebrows. Man, that sure was terrific. You know, gosh, I can remember that one night, you know, on drugs. And oh, my God. And so they don't associate the catastrophe of their existence with their behavior and understanding, you know, and learning when they were kids. So we just have to try to stop, you know, the sort of intellectual construction of this is a great idea. And this is going to be tough because, you know, the young males will basically want to, or they'll be attracted to the pornography. They'll be attracted to the drugs, the libertine lifestyles.
It's initially so attractive if you're 15 or 16 years old.
Sure.
I mean, obviously at that age, and when girls start to be attracted to you, you can be, you know, it's what's like. But because you have no, and so society should be there to guide them to institutions and protect them. They're no longer protected anymore. They're assaulted. But then again, you know, heck, I mean, to understand these things takes a lifetime of experience. So how do we expect, you know, 20-year-olds or 15-year-olds to understand this? I mean, when adults are still confused by it all.
Well, I mean, you know, so just, you know, here's the practical advice in my opinions is that, you know, you need to really get a large scale awareness of the weaponized anthropology, that malevolent weaponized anthropology specifically used against us. That has to be something that people talk about, people are, you know, open to discuss. And then I think we need to develop our own culture. We need to develop a culture that contains literature and film, which basically promotes the attributes that could lead to a future, you know, for ourselves, right? And for the people who want to engage in it. That particularly the young males would see that, you know, something. I get it. I can just sit here and do drugs and have sex with a lot of different people, but I can see that when I'm 30 or 40, I'll be like my father, who I've met once in my life, and you know, we did opioids together. You know.
This might go to the normie question that we talked about last week.
Yeah,
is acknowledging the malevolence and the tools or the institutions that is used to implement the malevolence, and that probably. Particularly is the educational institutions, because one of the methods by which the youth, particularly young women, men too, young men, is their inhibitions are eroded by mass events, the rock festival, parties, big parties, university setting, large centralized public high schools. This is where this immoral pornographic culture is normalized. And when everyone's doing it, your inhibitions are worn away and you feel comfortable doing it. This is what the mixed sex dorm life, the partying scene in college and these things. Yeah, but so many parents now think that they are obligated to send their kids off to these institutions where the kids are ruined psychologically, morally, intellectually, and pay for it or put their kids into debt to get it. So they can get this, you know, this meaningless degree, so they can come home and live in the basement or something. That's where you have to start to disengage yourself from supporting these malevolent institutions, and that's cutting off the cable TV, not supporting the entertainment, not going to the university and colleges anymore, realizing there's alternatives, these things, and that's one key way, that's one primary way that. The secret society, the oligarchs, get to these young kids and ruin them.
I mean, in the Kelly Atwell dating service questionnaire, I mean, you know, you know, males are you know, that watch NFL, that use Xbox, that you know, they are not permitted to date women. Sorry. You're just not. You're not there yet. You need a crash course in insanity.
Even sports. I mean, people love their sports. Even God-fearing men love the NFL. But you watch an NFL game or the NFL Network, and that's been highly sexualized. Now they have blonde bimbos talking about football on the NFL Network. Everything has to be sexualized. It's the weather report. It's a woman in a tight red dress. It's so you're constantly...
They're always titillating the male. They're always basically trying to find a way to get particularly young males between, say, 15 and 25, into the idea that the world is this, sexual playground. And, there's a wink and a nod, but really, don't worry about the future and just, have a lot of sex right now, because that's really fun and a good thing to do.
So
that's always in play in every single one of these shows.
Another example of pornography as a political weapon, I was reading about what happened in Germany in the 1970s, where the CIA used a German, he was a guy who left Germany in the 30s, became an agent for British intelligence. Forget the guy's name. But in the 70s, he was involved in the promotion of these pornography films in Germany, which could have sort of made fun of German traditional culture, particularly Bavarian Catholic culture. And this played a big part in the demoralization of the German, West Germany in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And of course, we see it now with plummeting birth rates and the sort of nihilism and skepticism. This is what this leads to. Also, the pumping in of huge amounts of heroin.
So this is, I think we've done a pretty good job of describing the carnage. And I think we've given some, suggestions as to how to move forward. I think we're going, what we really need to, also communicate is that, we need courage. Particularly, I think, women have to be courageous. Because they need to remember that, they are really the last bastion of sanity and future for our people. The males have been to such a large extent damaged. So, I would hope that European females can, find a way to communicate to the damaged males that they need to, to change their lives and find a way, and this is the tough part, to point out that this is the best life, that the life that can be created within a marriage and within a family and within, an extended family and within an ethnic community, this is where we will have the greatest happiness, that the superficial pleasure, that is being sold as, something that's a substitute for that is only going to lead you into an early grade misery and opioid addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So
you'll be eating, you'll be eating a TV dinner at 9 o'clock at night in your apartment, wondering where the years went.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, and trying to, find a way to afford hair plugs and a dye job, so that you can make it at the singles bar when you're 45 years old. This just isn't the world that there's anything to offer. The pleasure is so fleeting, and the lack of any kind of sustained meaning is so absent that you just have to appeal to these people's sense of intelligence, a sense of the future, that look, this just goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. And we've got enough people now. There's enough, we have the Kelly Atwell dating service. We also should have the cautionary tale collection, where we get, 45-year-old opioid males who have been watching pornography for 20 years and have had 3,000 sexual encounters. We should really have them come forward and just talk about how incredibly miserable they are, so that when you're 15 and you see someone like that talk about his life and what it really has been and what it means, they get it. They'll say, "Gee, I don't want to go there," That
well, yeah, a lot of this is just being mature about these things. And I mean, I would just remember when I was dating in my 20s, I got married in my early 30s, married a woman who was about 9 years younger than I was. What I would advise, I mean, just don't be too anxious and don't act like a cat or a jerk. I just remember my own wife, she introduced herself to me because she overheard me talking.
Yeah.
And I was talking about something.
What a great way to start a relationship.
Yeah, and she heard me talking, and it was something that wasn't, you know, something wasn't adolescent or piggish. I was, I was just at a pub. And if you just kind of play it that way, you'd be surprised if you're a guy out there is how many girls will find it refreshing.
Actual sane men are just so rare. Again, that's why the Kelly Atwell dating service, I think our phone will be ringing off the hook.
Yeah.
Once we can get a collection of, men that pass the examination. There's lots of different ways to move forward. We need to have a sense of humor with one another. I think women can't expect too much right off the bat from these guys, but as long as they're moving in the right direction, as long as they understand the goal, and as long as they're trying to develop, a real personality and to me, it's sort of like this kind of romance novel that I had in mind, where if both people recognize the damage that has happened, then this can actually be something that's interesting and can bind them together as they work through the damage. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be always just something that's just horrible and it's just there you are, and you're always going to be.
Yeah. Stop playing the victim.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, okay, well, we recognize it. We know where we want to go, and we're going to try to work with each other to bring out the damage, to try to correct it as best we can, and try to move into a real relationship, one that'll last.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything else?
Well, Tim.
So.
All right, brother. Well, that was interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll let you go.
All right, brother. Thank you so much. And we'll do it again next week. And we'll get the questionnaire for the Kelly Atwell dating service started.
Yeah. Online dating service. Hey, maybe we can make some money while we're at it, right?
Let's do that.
Okay. Well, listen, Joe, take it easy. Have a safe bye-bye. Trip then. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.